I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome back to Radio Times. Princeton University had been trying for about a decade to control grade inflation, the high numbers of A's that professors give to their students. The university decided to end its grade deflation policy that had been criticized by students who complained it disadvantaged them compared to other students at other elite universities and colleges. We asked Clancy Rowley, who chaired the committee to review Princeton's grading policies, to join us on Radio Times. He's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton. And Clancy Rowley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Let's start with the deflation policy. What was it? How was it supposed to work?
Well, maybe I'll start with the objectives of the policy. So
sure.
This policy was adopted in 2004, 10 years ago, and had two main objectives. One was to establish consistent standards across departments. So we had a problem that some departments were awarding very many A grades, others very few. So the goal was to have this be consistent so that students in one academic department could expect to be graded according to the same standards as in any other department. That was the first objective. The second was that the conviction that grades should give the students clear signals about the difference between ordinarily good work and the very best work. Obviously, if everybody gets an A grade, they don't receive those signals. So in order to the specific recommendation of the policy, the old policy in 2004 was that each department award no more than 35% of A-range grades for coursework.
Would you say, I mean, now 10 years later, the university has decided to end this policy. Did it not meet the requirements that had been hoped 10 years ago?
In some ways, it met the requirements. Actually, our committee was asked to start a bit before that and to evaluate whether these two objectives were the right ones. And they sound like very reasonable objectives, but in fact, our committee decided that the first objective was actually a bit misguided, this objective of consistency across departments. And the reason is that its standards are actually different from grades. So standards are really the evaluative rubrics that instructors develop to convey to the students the specific expectations for their work and against which they will be graded. And grades, on the other hand, measure the extent to which students meet those expectations. And the policy was not focused on standards. It was focused on grades, which we felt was inappropriate. So actually, we decided that the first objective was a misguided one. The other thing we were asked to evaluate was whether this policy was effective and whether it had objectives could be achieved with fewer undesirable side effects. And that's where much of our work in the committee focused, was on the undesirable side effects, which were significant here.
And what were those undesirable side effects?
Well, students complained that this policy encouraged fierce competitiveness, and the idea was that it poisoned the atmosphere on campus, turned classrooms into shark tanks, we heard from some students. Made a toxic learning environment, because the idea was that students were not working together and helping each other learn. Instead, they were competing with one another for what they regarded as a limited resource of A grades that they needed to make it to their next step, be it medical school or graduate school or a good job.
Were they, and I know one of the complaints or one of the worries was that by having this system, they could be disadvantaged in applying to medical school or graduate school or some kind of fellowship, because if someone from Harvard or Yale was doing that, they might have higher grades. Was that indeed true?
That's something that's very difficult to measure, just because it's hard to get real quantitative data, and I'm an engineer, so I like data.
Yes.
We really do not have enough data to make a definitive judgment, but we talked to many, many people from other institutions, our own medical school health professions advisor at Princeton, various employers, and as far as we could tell, there were actually no tangible side effects, with a small exception of students in ROTC, for whom grades are quite important actually to determine their final placement. But for other professions, we actually found no real effect. So it was much more a perceived effect among students, but it was having the real effect of poisoning the academic environment on campus.
I mean, was there anything, though, that you think professors could have done to address this toxic environment that happened after this policy was instituted, where students were not sharing information or studying together, but really competing with each other for the limited number of A's?
I do think there's, in fact, we heard some, you know, horrible stories from students in the course of our committee's deliberation. So some students said that on the first day of one class, his or her teacher said that only, this is a language class with 11 students in it. On the first day, the professor said, okay, only three of you will receive A grades. Well, this is not a good way to start a class, because it just gets the students thinking in this competitive mindset. And that's not the intent or meaning of the policy either. The policy does not say that in any given class of 11 students, you can only give three A grades. You know, it's supposed to be department-wide, and it's only a recommendation. But that was an instance where the instructor just did the wrong thing and, you know, should have. First, I think the instructor did not understand the policy as it was intended, but also encouraged this among the students.
Well, I mean, we know that Princeton is an elite university, a very selective university. I mean, is it just possible that all the students at Princeton are above average? I mean, that they all are essentially B+, A-, A students?
Certainly. I mean, all of our students really, I mean, I teach many students every year, and they are excellent. I mean, I'm so impressed with the quality of our undergraduates. And all of them have had very tremendous success in high school, too. But at the same time, it is true that there is a distinction between the work in any one class, certainly that I've taught. It's not true that, you know, all the students do A-quality work. There certainly is a range of the quality of work, and the idea is that grades should reflect that.
Mm. But I also wonder, I mean, if these are students that are probably used to getting A's. I mean, is there something about just the sort of cold reality? You get to a place like Princeton, it's going to be competitive, and not everyone is going to get an A. And perhaps, you know, compared to your peers here, you're not the A student that you were in high school.
Absolutely. That's a real effect here on campus, especially for first-year students. It's a real culture shock. And Princeton has been described, and all these Ivy League institutions have been described as pressure cookers. And what we were told in the course of our committee's deliberations was that our grading policy was keeping the lid down tighter on this pressure cooker and just making it more intense and even more competitive.
Mm. Were parents also applying pressure? Parents that, of course, you know, have big ambitions for their children?
Sure. It was the Our former policy was of great concern among parents and also alumni, and certainly current students.
So what is the policy now, then?
Well, our committee recommended removing this numerical target of 35%, the reason being that it was too often misinterpreted, for instance, in the small class I told you about, both by faculty and by students, and to shift the focus on quality of feedback rather than the fraction of A-range grades. Right. We're further charging departments with articulating their own grading standards specific to that field.
So the idea of feedback is that, yes, you might get a letter grade, but you're going to get more evaluation, a more sort of written evaluation from the professor?
That's right, yeah, to focus on timely feedback and specific feedback. So an example might be a course at the beginning of the course, rather than the instructor saying, okay, only 35% of you will get A grades. Instead of that, the instructor will say, here are the rubrics for this course and the standards, the expectations that I have for you. And if you meet these, you know, then you'll get the A grade.
There was also, I guess, a question or concern that since other Ivies, for instance, were not doing what Princeton was doing, is that students there, again, might have been disadvantaged, or that you were running an experiment that other universities did not want to run.
Well, certainly when we adopted this policy in 2004, the hope was that our peer institutions would also adopt a similar policy to address this inflation. Grade inflation was certainly not unique to Princeton. Unfortunately, that did not happen. I think that only made things worse for our students, made them feel that they were being disadvantaged relative to their peers at Harvard and Yale and Columbia.
How do you, though, understand, and we're going to be talking about this more with guests who will be joining us in just a couple of minutes, but how do you understand where grade inflation came from. And when you look at the statistics over, let's say, 50 or 60 years, I mean, it seems that more students in universities and colleges are getting A's. I rarely got an A when I went to school. I'll just add that.
Oh, that's very true. No, I mean, we looked at data. Actually, the data we looked at went just back to 1974. But from there, the average GPA in 1974 was just over 3.0, below 3.05. And then in 2003, before the policy, it was up to 3.37, something like that.
And the
tremendous inflation.
Right, and 3.0 is that's like a B?
That's a B average, yeah, and 4.0 is an A.
So where, I mean, from your perspective, having looked at this, where did that inflation come from?
Well, I think it's a number of factors. I think there's certainly an incentive for, I think all the incentives are to inflate grades, actually. So, I mean, higher grades lead to happier students, you know, happier campus life, less competitiveness. Students will be more successful when they graduate, presumably, if they have a higher GPA, and happier alumni. I think everybody is happier if grades are happier. I think that effect and just the overall accumulation over time is this, you're going to get inflation because of all those effects that encourage it.
But do you think colleges and universities should be in the business of making their students happier?
Well, of course, that's not the main goal of the college. The main goal of the college is to educate your students and really to, I would say, light a fire for and light a passion inside them to study what they love. And in order to do that, you need to give them good feedback about, you know, this is really excellent work. If everybody gets an A, then there's really no meaningful feedback. And students don't have incentive to, you know, really delve down deep into a subject and learn to love it.
You're a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering. So are you kind of rethinking the grades, not just the grades that you'll be giving, but how you'll be or how you are talking with your students about what you have to do in order to get an A or A minus or a B plus?
I am. So all departments and indeed all individual faculty are charged with developing these specific rubrics, which is not something that I actually had, you know, specifically articulated in my courses before. And now that's something I'm going to need to go back and specifically write down.
And we're almost out of time here, but does Princeton then seem like, yes, we ran this experiment, we learned some things, we're sort of refocusing on certain aspects of this? Do you think that was a good 10 years to learn something important about grades?
I do think we learned something important about grades, and I think probably the most important thing we learned was that any change in these policies, even something as seemingly innocuous as fixing a guideline, a numerical target, is going to have a cost and side effects, and it may be a cost that you don't anticipate when you make the policy.
Well, Clancy Rowley, thank you for getting our conversation started.
Sure.
And he's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at Princeton University. He chaired Princeton's committee that reviewed the university's grading policies. We're going to be talking more about grade inflation after this very short break. We have two guests who are waiting in the wings and always want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and we're going to be talking about grade inflation, where it came from, what it says about education, what, if anything, can be done to find a more realistic assessment of student achievement. And already the phones are ringing at 1-888-477-9499. Let me introduce our two guests. Arthur Levine is president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, former president and professor of education at the Teachers College at Columbia University, author of Generation on a Tightrope, a portrait of today's college student. Arthur Levine, a great pleasure. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
And also with us is William Derisiewicz. He's the author of a book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. He's a contributing writer for The Nation, contributing editor for The New Republic and The American Scholar. And William Derisiewicz, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And let me begin with you, William, which is, and I was talking with Clancy Rowley about what Princeton was doing, that the lessons that they believe they had learned by trying a grade deflation and now sort of rejiggering the program that they have there. How do you understand where grade inflation, what has been driving grade inflation over the years?
That's a great question. If we look at the history of grade inflation, we see that there was a huge surge of it during the Vietnam War. The reasons for that have been debated, maybe because professors wanted to keep their students out of combat by keeping them in college. Then it was flat from the mid-70s through the 80s, and it started to rise again and has been rising since about 1990. I think the main reason for that is what people call the customer service mentality. Colleges started to treat their students less as students and more as customers or consumers who, to use a word that your last guest used, needed to be kept happy. They feel that they're paying for high grades. They feel that their purpose of college is to help them get to the next step rather than what your last guest talked about, actually teaching them something. And I think this has been the main thing that's been driving grade inflation.
Let me turn to you, Arthur Levine. How do you see what's been driving grade inflation?
I think it began with the Vietnam War, as did the other guest. I think that, and the reason there was, students who didn't achieve certain grade point averages could be drafted. I think it continued as a consequence of, there's more and more graduate education at universities today, and the standard for graduation, or the standard for grading, is A and B. Those are the passing grades in grad school. I think they made their way down to undergraduate education. And finally, I think there's been real pressure on professors to give high grades.
For the same reason that William Derisiewicz, which is that we're dealing with a customer service model?
Yeah. It's too hard to be the professor who gives the low grades.
Let me quote something back to you, Arthur Levine. This was actually in the New York Times. You said, this is talking about students today, this is a generation that was not allowed to skin their knees. They got awards and applause for everything they did, even if it was being the most improved or the best trombone player born on April 5th. So it makes sense that they think very highly of their abilities and expect to go on getting awards and applause. Are you saying that this helps to explain grade inflation?
That's a piece of it. My data is somewhat different. It shows steady rises in grade inflation, but really shooting up in the 90s, since the 1960s. So in 1969, 7% of all college students got A minus or higher grades. Today, that's 41%.
Wow.
And in the C grades or less, went from 25% to 5%. And I think that I don't think that the fact that this generation hasn't skinned its knees is the reason we're seeing grade inflation. I think it's the reason that it's bad.
Because you need to skin your knees, right? You're saying you need to fall down and hurt yourself.
That's exactly it. Kids need to know what they do well and don't do well. Colleges ought to enrich what they do well and work on what they do less well. To have anything less is a diminishment of education.
Well, let me go back to you, and I'm old enough to have remembered people complaining about my generation that we were selfish and lazy and all the things that we were back in the 1960s. I mean, do you think we're talking about a really serious crisis here, or is it that it's this variation on the complaint about kids today?
No, I think it's important not to be diverted by that. It may well be the case that grown-ups have been complaining about kids since the dawn of time. It does not therefore follow that today's complaints have no merit. But I would also add that this isn't just about today's kids. First of all, they're not the ones who created the system of incentives that they're responding to. We did. Second of all, despite the fact that, at least according to the data I've seen, grade inflation may have been flat for a few years, this has basically been the same system for 40 or 50 years. This idea that college is there to serve, is there to make students happy, to treat them as customers, to pass them on to the next level, not to demand too much of them. I would actually throw in another thing that I think is very important, and I suspect our other guest agrees with. This is also easier for professors.
Mm.
It's easier for professors to give a good grade because you don't have to justify an A. You don't have to write a long explanation. You don't have to help the student get better. And so you can spend as much of your time as possible doing the thing that you're rewarded for, which is your research. So people talk about a mutual non-aggression pact between students and professors. To paraphrase what they used to say in the Soviet Union, they pretend to learn and we pretend to believe them. Or maybe I should say they pretend to grade us.
I know. Right. And we pretend. Right.
Right. And we pretend to learn. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is that if you're a professor and you taught at Yale University, so if you gave someone, a student, a C+, chances are they would want to sit down and talk to you about it, right? And perhaps you would hear from their parents because...
No, if you gave them a C+, chances are their head would explode.
Really?
If you gave them a B+, yeah. If you gave them a B... I mean, you only gave a C+ if a student was basically doing failing work. That C+ is the new F.
C+.
If you gave them a B+, you needed to sit down and talk to them about it. I didn't hear from students. I know other people who did. I mean, I'm sorry, from parents. But I certainly heard from students. And it takes a lot more work to give someone a B+ than it does to give them an A.
Do you agree with that, Arthur Levine?
Yeah, I do agree with that. The one difference or one thing I'd say is college students today, I don't think are any worse or any better than the students who came before. They're just different.
Right.
And what my research shows is they really need some sense of what they do well and don't do well. And grade inflation is hurtful in that sense. The other thing I'd probably add is I think both the assumptions that Princeton made in creating the deflation policy were correct. And I think they're going to lose something as a consequence.
But what we heard from Princeton was by having this deflation policy and by limiting the number of A's, it created a very sort of hyper-competitive environment, and they didn't like that, Arthur Levine.
You know, 35%, that's more than one out of every three students, is performing excellent work in each of their classes. That seems like a lot of students who are doing that. And the reality is, students don't get hurt by grading systems that are more accurate, so that I'm not really worried about that issue.
Well, let me turn back to you, William Derisiewicz, and you were a professor.
You can just call me Bill.
Okay, Bill. I'm kind of a first name, last
it's
name.
It's a lot easier.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's a lot easier, especially with your last
with
name.
With my name, yes.
No, fair enough. Now, you're an associate professor of English, or you were at Yale.
I was, yes.
So, and this is sort of a... kind of a fuzzy-wuzzy question, but so how, I mean, if someone is writing a report on, I don't know, A Tale of Two Cities or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what is an A? I mean, what is a B? What is a B plus? With math, you can, that's pretty obvious, but if you're dealing with something like English.
Right. And this is part of the reason that it's part of the reason that non-scientific subjects have a reputation for being soft. It is also true that grades tend to be higher in non-scientific departments. But there are absolutely our objective criteria. The criteria are not do you agree with my take on the novel, but have you made a logically consistent argument that respects the evidence of the text? Have you made an argument that's sound? As well as, you know, have you written sentences that are grammatically correct and coherent? Do your paragraphs follow one from the other? I mean, this is what you teach when you teach writing, when you teach freshman composition, and this is what I continue to expect of my students. And it is certainly possible to communicate those expectations to students so they understand why they've fallen short or why they've made, you know, why they've met expectations. It's not that this is arbitrary by any means, although I do feel that it can be a problem in humanities classrooms that it does become arbitrary or impressionistic or kind of loose.
To you, Arthur, and then I do want to get to our callers because the phones did explode the moment I said what we were talking about. But so if Princeton ran this experiment, it didn't work the way they had hoped it would work out, what do you think is a way to rein in, I guess, this inflation that seems to perhaps give students an inflated view of their accomplishments?
I really think that the kind of program Princeton had is the kind of program that should exist at universities around the country. I'm less concerned about the notion of students who feel it's become an environment in which it's person against person. That's really hard to imagine. The other thing is that when we look at the consequences of trying to deflate grades, it doesn't affect students in terms of applying to professional schools or graduate schools after. As a matter of fact, what Reed did, which does control grades, is that they wrote letters to every university and every graduate school, and students applied and explained the system. Students, the interesting thing about today's students is, let's see, not at Princeton, but nationally, 45% are taking remedial courses. And what we're finding in addition is 55% rate their courses as difficult or very difficult. Mm. After all of that, and 41% A's, 60% of students say their grades understate their academic abilities.
Understate.
That's a really bad situation for people who want jobs someday, to think they're as good as they think they are.
But are you saying that students in remedial, say English or whatever, that they're getting A's, which, I mean, they're in college in remedial courses and they're getting A's. Is that what you're saying, Arthur? Oh, we seem to have lost him. Bill, do you want to pick that up?
Yeah, I can't speak to that specific point, but he mentioned. I want to make sure listeners caught this. Reed College in Portland, Oregon, where I happen to live now, is an incredibly rigorous academic environment, much more so than the Ivy League, in my experience, actually. And one of the many ways that they create that environment is by not telling their students their grades. They get grades. It's not one of those colleges that doesn't have grades. They just don't tell them their grades, like the entire time they're in college. And the students don't think about their grades. And because people out there in graduate schools and the workforce understand what Reed College is doing and Reed College helps them understand, their graduates are not disadvantaged. I actually think there would be a very simple solution to this, which is you can deflate grades. And in addition to GPA, you give employers and graduate schools one other number, which is where does the student rank percentile-wise in their graduating class. So then you know what a 3.5 GPA means. Does it mean you're in the bottom 10% or does it mean you're in the top 10%?
What's so curious, and perhaps just because I'm an old fogey now, is that, you know, once you get beyond college or graduate school or medical school or whatever, is that no one cares what grade you got.
They don't, but it is certainly true that they care for the next step, or they care in a lot of contexts. I mean, certainly law schools and medical schools care a great deal. But like I said, I mean, you know, give them an honest grade and then tell employers and graduate schools where that puts them in their graduating class. So then they know.
I think we have Arthur Levine back. Do we have you back?
You have me back.
I'm sorry we lost you there. Bill was just talking about, besides giving out grades or perhaps even having grades but not necessarily sharing them with students as they do at Reed College, is give medical schools or law schools sort of where that student ranks within their class, and that would be very helpful information. Does that make sense to you?
I've never liked class ranks because students are studying a whole different variety of subject areas, so that I don't think they make any sense in that regard, comparing apples and oranges. But I think it is really important to let the graduate and professional schools know what your grading policy is, so that they recognize only 35% of our students can get A's, so B-plus may not be such a bad grade.
Let me see what Dan from, looks like Collingswood, New Jersey, has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
I used to be an adjunct at four different institutions, and two of which were very large research institutions, and they all seem to have moved to a majority adjunct model. And I think that that's an added pressure for professors. Every single semester you get student evaluations, and your job is largely dependent on that. So you find that every semester you're sort of being reevaluated for your position, and there's a large pressure to make students happy. And that's not to say that all adjuncts do that, but the pressure exists. And in addition, as an adjunct running from one college to the next, I think one of your guests commented on the time factor, how easy or not it is to defend a lower grade. You know, tenure professors get paid for preparation time, and adjuncts do not. So it's hard to find that extra time to build in to do that extra work to defend lower grades if you think it's warranted.
Well, Dan, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Bill, it sounds like you want to say something in response. Go ahead.
Oh, no, he's absolutely right. I mean, that's absolutely correct. The truth is that a tenured professor, their teaching evaluations are essentially meaningless. Even if you're on the tenure track, they don't mean that much because you're not being tenured for teaching. But the fact is that 75% of people who teach in American colleges now are not professors. Mm-hmm. They're adjuncts or graduate students or something else. And the caller is absolutely right. They really have to keep the customer satisfied.
To you, Arthur, about a minute or so before we have to say, actually take our break here, is if we're talking about grade inflation, is that pretty much across the board? We began by talking to someone at Princeton University. Is it also true in state colleges and even maybe community colleges?
Absolutely. The institution that doesn't have it is the rare exception.
As a rare exception. Yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Well, Dr. Levine, you may have different statistics than I do.
If you can be Bill, I'll be Arthur.
Okay,
Arthur.
Go ahead, Bill.
You may have different numbers than I do, but as I understand it, grade inflation in public institutions, it's happened, but it's much, much less. If the average GPA at privates is 3.4, at publics it's still around 3.0. And to me, that really speaks to this customer service idea. If you're going to a private university, you really feel like a customer, whereas you go to a public university, you sort of take what you can get.
Arthur?
And I think that further disadvantages public university graduates relative to people who go to places like Princeton and have a built-in GPA advantage.
A quick
whatever
response.
It's worth, my data doesn't show that, but okay. It's my data.
Okay.
That's your data. Fair enough. Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about grade inflation and it's rampant at universities and colleges across the country, maybe even more rampant at elite and selective colleges. Talking with Arthur Levine. He's the president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation, former president of Columbia University and former professor of education at Teachers College at Columbia University. Wrote a book called Generation on a Tightrope. Also with us, William Derisiewicz, author of Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life, a contributing writer for The Nation and a contributing editor to The New Republic, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Bill Derisiewicz and Arthur Levine about grade inflation. Let me get Keith from Doylestown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Keith. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the air.
Sure.
I have a good story, I think, that speaks to it. My brother and I are both doctors now. We're both practicing. I went to Rutgers. I was at Rutgers College at Rutgers University, and he went to Yale. I double majored in biology and economics, pre-med concentration. He was at Yale, did molecular biophysics, and picked that because apparently his advisors told him he'd have a better shot for medical school with it. Long story short, I had to bust my hump to make it through the science track, and the weed out was ridiculous at Rutgers. It was so bad that on our first day, and I graduated in 95, so I was there from the fall of 91 to spring of 95, I remember the first day of our organic lab class, we all met at a big lecture hall, 600-person lecture hall. Rutgers has lots of them that large. And they announced that they would be giving one, maybe two A's per organic lab section. So we went into this class knowing that you might be the only A. It was so bad that you would buddy up with someone for the intern because you had to share humors. So you'd find someone you were good friends with and that you could trust, and neither one of you could be away from the hood simultaneously. So if I needed to go get something, he had to stand there. If he got something, I had to stand there. Bathroom breaks, you just didn't do during the lab class. You had to hold it.
Yeah, Keith.
So if you walked away from your lab and
yeah, Keith,
it opens, you would have dumped something in and would take out your reagent.
Well, and only because we're losing some of the quality of your phone calling in. And is your point that you got? Do you feel like you got a better education than your brother?
No, he would basically give me the same story that he would have been in an organic lab. And basically, as long as you showed you could do the experiment, even if your final product was off a little bit by a gram here, a gram there. You got your A because you got it done. We had to have it not only perfect, but we had to have it more perfect. And in fact, our curves were not even in the sciences anyway, not even bell curved to the point where you had to look for a curve. We actually got curved down that you'd get something posted, and on the posting sheet, it would tell you where the A, B, and C was based on a percentage scale, where A might be a 94 on that lab section. The next one, it might be a 2. The next one, it might be a 96.
Well, let me just jump in here and actually
Anna
just... Keith, I got to pull you down. I'm sorry about that. But I think what he also is getting to, Bill, and let me toss this to you, and even looking through your book last night, I mean, students are under an incredible amount of pressure. I mean, he's talking about 1995, but you write about students today that, yes, maybe on the outside they look like they have it together, but inside, you know, their guts are are sort of tied up. Do we have Bill?
Mental health disorders at colleges across the country, because. You know, we're making them run faster and faster to jump through more and more hoops to get into these schools. But that doesn't follow that they are learning more and more. In fact, if anything, my experience and other people's experiences, professors I know at a variety of colleges, will tell you that they're actually less interested in the material, less intellectually curious, less willing to take risks, because they feel, first of all, they have to be perfect and never get anything less than an A, and second of all, because they're doing so many different things all at once that they can't give themselves in a deeper way that I think our first guest was talking about, really discover a passion because they are running in so many different directions all at the same time.
Arthur, you want to comment on that?
No, I'm going to pass.
Fair enough. We'll give you a passing grade for that. Let me see what Rick from...
I want an A.
Were you an A student, Arthur Levine?
I finished in the bottom quarter of my college class.
Did you?
I was one of those people who was pre-med, finished it, and in fact went to a private institution where things were as hard as described at Rutgers.
And you were in the bottom of your class?
Yes, but I had a wonderful time.
And how about for you, Bill? And I have to say, I had a very checkered academic career, but how about for you, Bill?
You know, I was a science major, which I shouldn't have been. I was an English major. I should have been an English major. And I didn't do so great in my science classes, and I did great in my English classes. So overall, it was sort of a wash. But I think my story exemplifies the fact that you need to think about why you want to study what you're studying and not just do what, you know, basically your parents think you should do.
Well, and it sounds like perhaps you didn't get such good grades in science and maybe better grades in English. And that helped to steer you in a direction where you are today.
Yeah, that's true. But I think there are better ways to learn that lesson. And I mean, I think a big reason I didn't get such great grades in science is because I wasn't that into it after the first year or two, and I didn't have the sense to recognize that was an important data point.
Arthur, let me go back to you. And one of the solutions for grade inflation is to say we're only going to give out, you know, only a third of the class is going to get A's. But why even do that? Why have any kind of criteria or percentage that a percentage of the class is going to get an A? I don't understand that.
The goal was to try to limit it. The university already had a higher percentage than 35% receiving A's. So by limiting it to 35%, it was an effort to cut the grades, to reduce the level of inflation. And that's kind of interesting, don't you think?
I do. To you, Bill, let me go back to you. And apparently at Harvard University, it's not unusual to get an A. Now, of course, it's, you know, those are pretty bright students, but what are we to make of that?
Well, again, I mean, I don't buy this argument that they're all excellent, so they should all get A's. I mean, everybody out in the world understands that they are, or at least in theory should be, being measured Harvard students against other Harvard students. I'm not sure that I like the wisdom of predetermining how many A-type grades there should be, but I also know from my experience that students will get A's or A-minuses when the professor knows that their work isn't necessarily that good. I mean, you hear that, you know, oh, you gave this kid an A in your class. He's like, well, yeah, he was pretty good. I think if we were just willing to be honest about the kinds of work students, the level of work students do, this might take care of itself. You know, students, it's funny, they want the A's, But they also appreciate it when you're honest with them because they know. I mean, they've become very cynical about this because they know that it's kind of baloney, the grades that they're often getting. And I think they feel this sense of fraudulence about it.
You agree?
Even though in practical terms, they want it. They know they need to get to the next level. But, I mean, I think there's this sort of sense of emptiness that comes out of it. Like, I'm not really getting the real deal here.
A disservice, Arthur?
Yeah. When we talk to employers, the way employers describe this generation is saying they're very thin-skinned. They don't take criticism well, having not gotten it before. And they expect promotions and raises the first week on the job. So that, that's why I think it's a really bad idea to give everybody A's. It only encourages that kind of behavior. And once they get out into the real world, everybody doesn't get A's. If we can tell them what's not working in terms of what they do, what skills they need to build, that's a really good thing to do. Colleges and universities are educational institutions. They're not simply certifying institutions.
We haven't really talked about parents, but Arthur, do you think that's the sort of missing, leg on this stool when we talk about grade inflation?
Yeah, it's a part of it. And we've all heard terms helicopter parents, and there's also snowplow parents.
Oh, dear.
And the list of items goes on and on. Dean at Cornell told me parents' weekend has become parents' week. They just don't leave.
Oh, goodness.
And I've heard I don't know how many stories of parents calling deans about their kids' grades or professors. 27% of all college students say they've had a parent call a professor or administrator to complain. So that, yeah, that's an important part of it. But all of it's an important part of it, which is to say parents are an element. Students coming to your office and wanting to know why I got an A- instead of an A is a problem. And so is litigation a problem. So is being the professor, one of the very few professors who gives very low grades, which is why you need a policy like Princeton had.
What is a snowplow parent? I know the helicopter, but what's a snowplow parent?
Well, they're also
lawnmower
parents.
Oh, they clear the way. Is that what it is?
They clear the way, yeah.
Oh, wow.
But if I could...
Stealth parents.
What's that?
Stealth parents.
Stealth parents. I got you. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, if I could just add one more thing to this. We probably know that the U.S. News rankings has a huge effect on everything that happens in a higher ed and has really reconfigured a lot of the way students and colleges behave. One element of their rankings is graduation rate. Your graduation rate goes down if you flunk people out. Graduation rates at the most elite institutions tend to be in the high 90%. And someone, actually a trustee at Reed College who was a student at Yale, said something very smart to me a couple of weeks ago. He said, to me, the fact that Yale has a 97% graduation rate is a terrible sign. It means something is terribly wrong there if nobody flunks out. And again, that's true across the range of highly selective schools.
Let me get Rick from Fishtown to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rick. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I actually have two related questions. One is I'm wondering what the influence of sites like Rate My Professor are. I teach in New Jersey. I won't say where. But I've noticed that students will sort of look for easy classes to take. That's just a comment. But then also I was wondering if you considered the fact that I teach a range of courses, an intro course and also some upper levels. And there are big differences in the grade distributions in those courses. So when I grade my intro exams, I understand that lots of people may not do well. Whereas in a lab type course where everyone's putting in effort, the grade may be based more on effort, in which case you'd be giving out more A's and B's. So I'll take my the answers off the air. I just wanted to chime in on that.
Oh, I'm glad you chimed in, Rick. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Bill, can I toss that first to you?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have too much to say about this. It is true that they vary, say, from department to department. Science is grade harder. Intro courses tend to have lower grades. I think that's an aspect of it. I don't think it's a major. And as for Rate My Professors, it's become a website. But the fact is that these kinds of evaluations have existed for a long time for internal purposes. So professors have known for a long time that they're sort of being judged by their students, and they need to pay attention to that.
So A for effort, is that okay with you, Arthur?
the websites are, they'll spring up. They're a fact. They're a reality today. There's nothing that one can do about them except accept them.
But I, you know, I don't, I mean, sort of like inflation itself, it's sort of, it's hard to imagine we will sort of step back from this trend that we have been talking about, because there is so much competition and so much sort of worry about the future. You know, students have student debt that they have to deal with on top of all that we have been talking about. I just, I don't see deflation coming, Bill.
Well, you know, I think you may be right. I think everybody would have to hold hands together at the same time and promise to do better. And that may not be realistic. But, you know, it's really a matter of whether colleges are going to take their mission as educational institutions seriously, or whether they're going to become, as Arthur said, just credentialing institutions and just basically nonprofit corporations who are acting in the marketplace and not upholding their, the ideals that they exist to uphold.
Let me get Herman from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Herman. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a professor here in Philadelphia, and I think that both guests have hit it right on the head. I'm an English professor. I give every grade that you can get. And I do that because I just know that if I give a student a B or I give a student an F, or I don't give them a grade because the paper's not worthy of a grade, I know that I have to spend the extra time to help that student recognize what they need to do to get a better grade. It has to be like that. If we lie to students, we are setting them up for failure later.
So you do give out D's and F's, Herman?
Yes, absolutely. I don't give them up often. I teach at a private school. Students are very good. But if we give them C's for work that is inferior, we are setting them up for failure.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Arthur, he used the word lie. I mean, if you're giving someone an A for C work, that's a lie.
It is. And I think the sad part about it is the only person who really suffers the consequence is the student who was lied to. I think it'd be a far better practice to limit the number of A grades and give students a chance to redo their work when they've gotten a bad grade. Mm. That's a great educational opportunity to say, here's what didn't work, and go rewrite this paper, and I will give you another grade.
I'm nodding my head there. That doesn't really work on the radio. Bill, go ahead.
But I mean, I love the last two things that have been said. It depends on giving professors and instructors the incentive to do this, which means caring about teaching again, paying people real salaries to do real teaching, and judging professors not just on their research, but also on their teaching, right? So this is not just we should do better, these are good ideas. It takes a commitment of resources, you know? I mean, the reason there's so many adjuncts now, 75%, is because they get paid peanuts, right? Schools are spending on everything except instruction. Or, you know, if you look at the budget lines at universities, all of them are going up except instruction. And this goes back to the customer service mentality. If you're trying to appeal to 18-year-olds to come to your school, football team, football stadium, football coach, nice dorms, nice rec centers, nobody cares about the physics professor, nobody cares about the history professor. This is where things started to go wrong.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but the clock tells me I do have to do that. William Derisiewicz, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks very much.
And he's the author of a book called Excellent Sheep, The Miseducation of the American Elite and the Way to a Meaningful Life. Arthur Levine, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
He's the president of the Woodrow Wilson National Fellowship Foundation. His book is Generation on a Tightrope, A Portrait of Today's College Student. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including things like how to download a podcast, how to check out the archives, and more information about the show. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Quinn Lipson is our intern this fall. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscone. Thank you so much for joining us.